This episode of the Innerman Show is brought to you by The Beard Struggle. The Beard Struggle is a beard grooming essentials company based out of British Columbia, Canada. What makes The Beard Struggle so great is their view on masculinity, that it is not a beard that makes you masculine, but growing in love, grace, self-sacrifice, and service. The Beard Struggle has all natural ingredients that are never animal tested. They have combs, bags, heated brushes, balms, oils, shampoos, and conditioners, all guaranteed to give you a stronger, healthier beard. If you don't like their products, they offer a 90-day money-back guarantee. Well, let's face it, guys. The Beard Struggle is the best of the best. Head over to www.thebeardstruggle.com and use promo code INNERMAN, INNERMAN, for 15% off your next purchase.
The Innerman Project is happy to announce that we have teamed up with Alberta Strong for their fall-winter campaign. Alberta Strong is an Alberta-based clothing brand that aims to give back to Alberta through supporting nonprofits and special events. Alberta Strong will be donating $500 to the Innerman Project to support community programs such as the Unmasked Masculinity peer-to-peer group sessions. And not only will they be donating $500, they are going to be donating $5 of every online purchase from now until December 31st, 2020 to the Innerman Project. You can find Alberta Strong on Instagram at alberta.strong, on Facebook at www.facebook.com/AlbertaStrong1905. Make sure to check out their website, www.albertastrong.org.
Make sure you check us out on social media. Our Instagram and Twitter is at InnermanYXH. You can also find us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/TheInnermanProject. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast. We are available on every podcast app and podcast player. If you enjoy the show, let us know, tag us, and leave a review. And last but not least, we have officially launched our online platform for the Innerman Project merchandise. We have tees, hats, hoodies, and car decals. All of the tees and hats and hoodies are also in men's and women's. Head over to Instagram or Facebook, tap shop now, or use the link in the bio, and use promo code INNERMANSHOW for 10% off your entire purchase. Again, use promo code INNERMANSHOW for 10% off your entire purchase. This is a promo code exclusively for the Innerman Show listeners. Again, that's promo code Innerman Show, INNERMANSHOW, for 10% off your entire purchase. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Innerman Show. I'm your host, Dylan Eckes. I'm here with my co-host tonight, Shane Cockrell. Shane, I know you're exhausted, buddy. Tell me what's going on.
We just slammed with some snow over the last few days here, and it has been ridiculous. And for some reason, I decided to take traveling on as a side gig, and it has kicked my butt so far. So really, really pumped about that so far.
Yeah, the shoulders and the abs are pretty sore, hey?
Oh, yeah.
All right, Shane. So tonight we have a very special guest. This gentleman is an author. This gentleman is a father. He's a husband and he's a mental health advocate. Please welcome to the show, Todd Rennebaum. How's it going, man?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm good, man. Thanks for doing this tonight. So before we get started in talking about your book and talking about your journey, let's give the listeners a little bit of info of who you are and what you do.
Well, I live in Indian Head, Saskatchewan, a town of maybe 1,500 people, just outside of Regina. I work at a addiction treatment facility. It's actually the same one I went to about 4 years ago. And I'm kind of like, I'm addiction support is what they call me, but I basically like a temporary sponsor when the counselors aren't there during the day. And I've been advocating for different things in mental health over the last few years. I started off big picture protesting against the government and petitioning government. And now I've kind of brought it down to a smaller focus by working with people one-on-one in addiction and writing this book. I'm a suicide attempt survivor and I'm in recovery.
That's fantastic, man. So when you say that you tried to take on government and have reform and change, what were you doing? Because I saw there was a couple of pictures. I saw that you were holding signs, you're doing some protests and some marches. So what was going on there?
Well, it must have been about 6 years ago. No, well, four or five years ago, I guess, after I had some complications with mental health after my suicide attempt and stuff. The local hospital in Regina, they were shutting down, or no, they were shutting down. They were getting rid of about seven different jobs at the psych ward in the hospital. And after being in there, I could tell already, like, the staff were, like, drained and like, I mean, they needed more support, not cut seven jobs. So I was really pissed off, and I wrote this really lengthy letter, and it ended up going viral, man. Like, it's been shared over 10, 15,000 times. And the media picked it up. It was basically saying how I was in the psych ward and I'm a suicide attempt survivor, and I saw and I dealt with the staff and all this stuff. And so then that kind of started my advocacy work. So then a couple of weeks after that letter kind of went viral, I decided to basically just have a mental health march in front of the legislative building in Regina. And nothing specific. I didn't know what the hell, and I didn't know a shit about what I was exactly protesting. It was just basically holding up signs saying more money for mental health. It wasn't until later that I realized just how underfunded it is in Saskatchewan. To actually compete with other provinces on money spent for mental health and addiction, Saskatchewan would have to spend another $150 million a year. So we're really behind on stuff. And that may have changed over the last year or so, but if it has, it hasn't changed much. Then the other time I did a march, it was, another time I petitioned the government to create a mental health and addiction minister in the government. And 2 days ago, they announced that they have created a minister of mental health and addiction. So I like to think I took a little responsibility for that. But that same minister also has other duties. It's like, I can't remember, seniors health and some other thing. Another time was a local teenager here in Indian Head, who lived two blocks down from me. He ended up taking his life, and his mother approached me about doing a march or a protest, I guess, a rally, we'll call it. Protesting sounds negative. We had a rally in front of the legislative building. We did speeches and talked on the steps of the legislative building, and people came out of the crowd and shared their stories about the lack of mental health. So we did two of those. And then I started getting really frustrated. Doing big picture advocacy work I'm one man and I'm trying to change, you know, of the world. So I actually decided to scale it back a bit and actually focus more on one-on-one with people and really, you know, be boots on the ground more. So I started working in the addiction center that I went to, and written this book. And, you know, it's, I have a little page on Facebook called Sometimes Daddy Cries. That's the name of the book. And just kind of share, I don't know, inspirational stories and articles and stuff like that on there. So I actually find scaling down and working in a smaller bubble is a lot more rewarding than trying to change the world all at once. So, and I've said before that the most effective way to change the stigma and to change mental health in government is starting small with yourself, opening up to your family, letting your family know who in your family suffers from mental health, instead of, you know, it's always hush-hush about why Uncle Fred is never around or, you know, stuff like that. So really talk open about mental health, because I'd go to the government to, you know, complain or whatever, petition, and unless people are willing to come out of the woodwork to talk about it themselves, then, you know, it's like just shouting at a wall. So that's kind of some of the stuff I've been doing in the last few years.
Well, the work you've been doing has been very admirable, and obviously not only just on the large scale, but on a smaller scale as well. Working in that, that treatment center, what kind of perspective has that given you aside from that large scale? So the smaller scale where the boots are on the ground, like you said, how does that feel, sharing your experiences with these people? And do you find that it's, been successful in you know, having people get through whatever they're going through?
Somewhat. I've been told that the treatment center I work at, which is Pine Lodge Treatment Center, it's one of the more successful. We have a higher success rate than quite a few other treatment centers. So just that alone, it's rewarding to work there. It was also actually being a client and going through there. My eyes really opened up to what addiction is. I wasn't even convinced I was an addict. So it was like, I was there for 4 weeks. It was the end of my first week. I was like, you know what? I think I might be an alcoholic. Yeah. But everyone else around me knew I was an alcoholic, but it took me a week of being in treatment to realize it. But you never have one-on-one counseling. It's always in a group. So listen to other group members' stories, and they're slipping through the cracks, and just how close anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar, all those things are so closely linked and tied to addiction that it really opened up my eyes to, you know, maybe instead of just, you know, petitioning the government for more money for mental health, addiction is just as important, if not more so. I mean, not more so, but it just how close that link is, that it's super, super important. So, and actually this year in Saskatchewan, there's already been over 300 deaths, overdose deaths. And that's like quadrupled or something like that. Some ridiculous number from the previous years. So, I mean, and that's not including suicides, murders, and unreported deaths. So it's almost one a day in Saskatchewan, of a province of less than 1 million people. So, you know, we talk about COVID, and I know COVID is a very serious subject, but we have a death a day when it comes to addiction. So it's near and dear to my heart, but I don't know if I answered your question or not. I kind of trailed off there.
I mean, like you kind of alluded to, it's a pandemic on its own. Addiction and mental health for the most part is a direct tie. So that's kind of what we're all battling right now and on the mental health team, I guess we would call it. It's something that if it isn't recognized, it should be, due to like the low population in Saskatchewan. One a day is very high.
Yeah. There's been like that's deaths, like, you know, and then, you know, you could quadruple that of actual overdoses that haven't passed away. So, I mean, you talk about COVID swamping the hospitals. There's, you know, how many people going through addiction problems and overdoses and detoxes. And our treatment center was shut down for months during COVID. And it was like probably the most important time people needed detoxing and treatment was during a pandemic. And there's absolutely no hell. There wasn't even AA and NA meetings that were shut down. So, I'm not trying to battle COVID with addiction. What worse than another, but you know, it's just kind of a frustrating time to work in addictions and mental health.
When you needed it most, it wasn't really there. And we ran into that as well here. So it was a sad time, and gladly things are right back and rolling here for us. So.
I'll battle addiction with you, Todd. Absolutely. Especially when it comes to this conversation with the COVID and the government. I mean, our government right now has made it very clear that their main focus is mental health and addiction because of the substantial increase that we've seen here in Alberta, specifically in Southern Alberta here, you know, the Calgary through Medicine Hat region. It's just, you know, in Medicine Hat here, I mean, we're talking, you know, numbers we've never seen before in suicide. And that's not even taking into account the overdoses. You know, so when you say that you're not trying to compare it, but there's a direct correlation what we're seeing this year in 2020 with what's been happening because of the lockdowns, because of the extreme measures, you know, people can't work. And next thing you know, they're on the bottle or they're popping the pills. They're trying to take the pain away. They're trying to numb the pain away. And so it's a vicious cycle, right? And that's why, you know, individuals like yourself, Todd, and, you know, the Innerman Project here, we're trying our hardest to at least have a conversation about this thing because it's what's needed right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, kudos to you guys as well for all the work you guys are doing. So.
And we're just a bunch of guys help. You know what? It really just comes down to just a bunch of guys helping guys, because we understand, you know, we understand what's at stake, and literally lives are at stake, you know. I want to go back a little bit to what you do for a living now as a support member to these people coming into the addictions treatment center. You know, you mentioned that you didn't even notice you were an addict. I was addicted to pain medication when I was competing as a bodybuilder. And you're right. You know, you keep going through the motions and you go through life, and then all of a sudden you have to take a step back, and it's a knock on the ass that, you know, convinces you, oh shit, you know what? I do have a problem. Right. Tell us a little bit about your backstory and how you came to write this book, Sometimes Daddy Cries.
Sure. I mean, I've always lived with anxiety, and to be honest, I didn't even know what the hell anxiety meant until I was probably in my mid-20s. But when I was in grade 4, I was actually diagnosed with a stomach ulcer. That's how bad of anxiety I had as a kid. I'd practically puke blood. But after leaving high school, you know, like, things kind of leveled out. You get some girls, you start drinking, you start partying and stuff. And I didn't realize, like, joined a band and I was having a good time. Little did I know, joining the band was the nice base of my addiction problem starting. But it wasn't until I was probably around drinking every day, smoking marijuana basically daily. I had a job that I was really unhappy with. I was working with people that made me very unhappy to be around. I started going on antidepressants right around the age of 30. And I really didn't, like, I knew I had depression problems too, but I really just started self-medicating. And I just, you know, that whole whirlpool of cycling down between trying to self-medicate and also not really seeing anyone. At one point, you know, I was making horrible life decisions. I was a horrible husband. I was a horrible father. I was a terrible employee. I was basically doing anything that would make me feel good, even if it only lasts 5 minutes at a time. And eventually, one day at lunch, I actually just got up from my supper table or my lunch table, and I just got in my car and I started driving. I had no idea where I was going. My wife called me. She's like, "Where the hell did you go? You were just here 2 seconds ago." And I was driving myself to, I didn't really know. I was just driving around. She kind of convinced me to drive myself to the hospital in Regina to the psych ward. So I did that. My parents, my sister kind of were calling and checking on me. My sister lives in Regina, so she came and met me at the psych ward. And, you know, I told the psych nurse in ER that I was suicidal, that I was miserable. I was all these crappy life decisions I was making. Psych nurse basically said, you know, keep seeing your counselor, keep seeing your therapist, keep taking your meds. You know, I believe you're suicidal, but you seem pretty good, so we're going to send you home. And that happens constantly. Little did I know then. So I went home and I felt embarrassed. In fact, that actually, like, I never, ever, ever sought help for my mental health before. So to me, going to the hospital was a huge step for me. And then to be sent home, I was actually embarrassing. Like, I felt like an idiot for even reaching out and looking for help, because they basically just said, "You're fine, go home." So over the next year, I just kept declining, making more and more shitty decisions, smoking more weed, drinking more every day, and not looking for help, because the last time I looked for help, they basically told me, you know, get out of here, kid. I was kind of seeing a therapist a little bit, but you know, I wasn't doing the homework he wanted me to do. And a lot of this cognitive therapy, and I'm sure cognitive therapy works on a lot of people, but I don't know. It wasn't working for me. Of course, I wasn't doing the homework, but anyway. So after about a year, it was almost a year to the date, I kind of cut some ties with some people in my life, thinking that might help with some of these shitty decisions I was making. I had a few beers with my brother. My wife and I were going to host a party for a friend. And I got home and my wife was, she kind of made a couple comments, negative comments about me not being there sooner to help with the party. And I snapped. And I literally, at that point, I snapped. I had a psychotic episode, and some of it is dream state. Some of it's like people told me what happened, but I just started punching my face as hard as I could. Freaked my wife out. She grabbed my kids, ran out of the house. I don't really remember what happened, but there was holes in the walls for my head. I just freaked the fuck out. Little did I know, my wife went to my brother's house, who I was just drinking with, and said, you know, Todd's losing it. You got to go help him. And so he came over, and I don't remember our conversation at all, but at one point I grabbed the knife. And so back up a little bit. Over the last year, like I said, I was declining. I mean, I was almost obsessing about suicide. I crossed the highway, the number one highway, to go to work every day. And there was always semis crossing. You know, there's times where, I didn't even want to stop at the stop sign. I just wanted to cross the highway. I had places at work that seemed like great places to hang myself. Almost every night when I was drinking my last gin, I was taking knives and holding against my throat, against my wrist. So I'd done enough practice and research and obsessed enough that I knew this was, I grabbed the knife and I was about to, that was a big knife. I was going to hack my arm off is what I was going to do. And I have a very big brother. He came after me and I kind of swung at him with a knife. And I lifted the knife again to take it to my wrists. And again, I have a very big brother and he basically just punched me in the head as hard as he could. I went down, he screamed for his wife, who I didn't even know was there. Cops came and they were actually trying to arrest my brother because they didn't know what the hell was going on. They just saw a knife and a big guy on top of a smaller guy. Once they figured it out, they're manhandling me and I get an arm loose. I grab one of the cops' guns to shoot myself. I didn't get out of the holster. I just grabbed it and they twisted me up and cut me and threw me in their vehicle. I think they had a little powwow in the house to figure out what the hell to do with me. And they were kind enough to actually take me to a hospital. No charges were laid. So now I'm in the psych ward in Regina and I was in there for a couple weeks. Quite honestly, I had no idea what I was doing in there. I remember what happened, but I didn't know what the hell I was supposed to do in there. It's like, this is the psych ward. Like, is there, what do? I just sat around and watched TV. I'm like, I don't even get the fuck do I do in here? So then from there, over the next year, like once they let me out, I kind of chilled out. I kind of admitted some stuff to my family, some of these, like I said, some of these crappy decisions and whatnot. So I kind of had some therapy and dealt with some shit, chilled out for a year. It was funny, a couple times people from AA came into my room to try to talk to me about AA. And I thought, what the fuck are these people talking to me for? Like, I'm crazy. I'm not an alcoholic. Like, fuck, you're crazy. Why are you talking to me? I really didn't get it. My first week home, I'm walking downtown Indian Head and someone from the local AA chapter here approaches me downtown and starts talking to me about AA again. I'm like, this is the third time in a week that someone's talking to me about AA. Like, what the fuck are with these people? Like, what a bunch of psychos. It took me 2 years to figure it out. But so anyway, eventually, about 2 years later, this whole thing about these jobs being cut at the psych ward, I write this letter that goes viral or whatever. And I had another little mini breakdown just because of the pressure of this advocacy work that was like, I didn't want to be an advocate. I was just writing this letter. And next thing you know, people are coming out of the woodwork wanting to talk to me. It was like, almost like, I don't know. There's a lot of pressure just to be an advocate. So anyway, I did quit drinking for a little while, but at this point I started drinking again. I was using marijuana constantly. I mean, from the time I woke up to the time I went to bed, I was smoking pot, drinking every night. The one night I decided, I had been trying to cut back on both marijuana and booze for probably 6 months and I just couldn't do it. Like I'd quit marijuana for an hour and I couldn't handle it. I'd be smoking again. Or tonight I'm not going to drink. And within 2 hours, I'm buying six beer again or 12 beer, whatever. So I knew I wanted to quit. One night I'm in my garage drinking by myself, smoking marijuana by myself, like I did every night. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go in the house, drink all the booze in the house. When my wife wakes up in the morning, I'll say all the booze in the house is gone. You know, maybe let's keep it this way for a while just to see how it feels. Of course, by drinking so much goddamn booze, I got myself so fucking drunk. And I was already fucking high. I was already getting suicidal thoughts again. So I came into the house, and actually that's when I wrote the first draft of this kid's book. I don't know too many people that write kids' books so fucking drunk that they don't remember writing it. But, so I wrote the first draft, and then I walked into my bedroom. I woke my wife up at like 3 a.m, and I said, I'm going to hurt myself again. I know it. I'm going to do something bad. Like, I'm in bad shape. So she starts calling the hospital and calling the people. I'm in the bathroom puking, and that's the last time I drank. She took me to the hospital, and I had an amazing doctor that let me detox in the hospital. He wanted me to change my life. He wanted me to start going to meetings. He wanted me to find a addictions counselor, and he wanted me to go to treatment. And so I did those, and I've been sober ever since. So it was kind of that day I wrote the book was like, I don't know, my higher power day. I don't know what the hell happened. So anyway, that's my backstory. And then my little story about the first draft of the book was the night I got sober. Sorry, I was rambling there.
No, not at all, man. Congratulations on, you know, the sobriety. That's humongous. It's, you know, when I read your kind of your story there on the blog, and I was like, wow, he wrote a book when he was lit up and, you know, drunk out of his mind. But it's like you said, it's like that higher power. It was like that shift in consciousness almost. It was like, okay, this is the start of something new. Even I'm in the middle of the shit right now. I'm in the middle of my adversity. I need to start making a change. And, you know, that's powerful, man. That's powerful. Shane, you had something to say?
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, so just we're running into that issue. I just want to pinpoint that embarrassment piece when you know, someone wants to go and check in and get some help from the hospital or wherever they end up going, and they end up more often than not they come out embarrassed or no help at all. Yeah. And it's absolutely disgusting. And then yeah, like they said, well, you've seen a psychiatrist for 2.5 minutes, you're good to go, see you later. Yeah. It doesn't encourage people to actually find that help that they need. And you having that kind of aha moment when you started writing that book, it's too bad that more often than not, that something like that has to happen for, you know, that flip of the switch, be like, okay, it's time to get better. And that was your moment, which is amazing, but it's so sad that that has to happen for someone to actually make a change and luckily you had the right doctor in place at that time. If you didn't, who knows where you would be?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think sometimes I don't appreciate just how powerful of a moment that night was. Maybe, I don't know. That's how I feel sometimes. But after I wrote that letter too, I explained this whole story about how I went a year before and I was asked to leave, and man, did people come out of the woodwork. I mean, they said, I've lost family members, or that happened to me. Apparently it happens daily. Like, even nurses and doctors were writing me and coming out of the woodwork to say, you know, like, this is bullshit. Like, someone comes to the hospital with a broken arm and they say, you know, well, there's not much we can do. Come back when you have two broken arms and both broken legs. Like, the one guy actually said to me, you know, until you've really attempted suicide, there's not much we can do. I was like, what the fuck? Like, so until I've actually attempted, what if I'm successful? So you're basically saying you're not going to help me.
Like, that was fucking... Yeah, it makes no goddamn sense, man.
No. And after I wrote that letter, the CEO of the health region wanted to meet me, so we spoke for a bit, and he agreed. He said, like, there's no help for early, mid mental illness problems. It's basically a triage. Once it's, almost beyond point of no return, that's actually when you get to have a hospital stay. So, I mean, things are changing a little bit in Saskatchewan with mental health, but I don't know, man, it's still, there's still not much room in the hospitals. And I don't know. I mean, yeah, there's some education and the police are getting more social workers on and stuff like that. But when it comes to actually getting help, it's like, you know, like when you're in an actual crisis, it's still, it's pretty lacking still. Actually, this spring or this, yeah, I think it was this spring, a young guy in Regina went to the psych ward. Same thing happened to him. He saw somebody, he left. An hour later, they found him dead in Wascana Lake. And the family's now suing the health region because there's like video footage of him in the hospital, like asking for help in the waiting room. So it's still pretty lacking that way.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure that Saskatchewan is alone in that. At least this is what we battle in Alberta. And it feels like in our private forum, like every province and even places in the States, it's just so, there's just nothing going for it. There's no actual plan in place to, you know, help fix people or try to get them the help that they need and deserve. I mean, people are treating mental illness like it's we have a choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's right. I did a little interview with a guy from Saskatoon on CBC, and he was, I think it was around the same time I was doing the trying to get a mental health minister. He was trying to get a separate ER system. So it's a mental health ER system. So you're not sitting there for 6 hours in the waiting room for, you know, you're suicidal. You're sitting, of course, people just get fed up and fucking leave. So there, and I think it's Saskatoon, actually, they do, but there's this really wealthy family that has donated millions of dollars, and that basically the Dubé family in Saskatoon, they have a really great mental health psych ward. And I think they do have their own ER to that psych ward, but it's just, you know, it's still fairly small. And even then, the government, the family said, here, we'll fund this whole thing. We'll build the building. And the government said, well, we don't want to staff it. And I think there's enough uproar that they reversed their decision and said, okay, we'll staff some nurses for an ER for a psych ward. Like, it's fucking frustrating. And it's not even political. It's not even political lines. Like, it doesn't matter who's in power. This shit is just, it's just ridiculous.
No, it is frustrating. Oh, sorry, Shane.
Yeah, no worries, man. And don't get us wrong. There is some pretty solid programming out there, but like you said, they're usually small, and there's usually a big wait list. And I know at least in our city, in our community, and others kind of in Alberta, deal with those 8 and 12 month wait times. And that's just way too damn long for people that are struggling. And if you can get there, and it's not everyone fits the bill for every single thing. So you're expecting something to change your life after 8-10 month wait. You're like, you're holding on to that. And you're like, finally, I'm going to get the help that I need. And then it's not a good fit for you. And then that just poses a huge problem. Then you feel like there's nothing.
Yeah, and here's the thing I'll say to that, Todd. I want to add on to that as well. Is so we did, when we started the Innerman Project, we got some traction like right out of the gate in terms of media coverage. And right after we did one of our CTV interviews, another local chat here, they did a basically an interview with somebody with some organization, and they were like, well, we have the community resources and the resources and the programming and the training are all available. We're here for you. And I was like, bullshit. That's complete and utter bullshit. Your programs might be in place. Your training programs might be in place. The resources might be there, but absolutely nobody knows about them. And what's frustrating is if people knew about them, the people in Medicine Hat might still be alive. You know, the people in Saskatchewan might still be alive if they knew these programs were available to them.
Yeah, that's right. And now working in addictions, I hear stories every day of clients coming in and saying they went to the psych ward for help and they were basically turned around, asked to leave because they were just high. It's like, well, fuck, you know, like, yeah, they're high. Of course they're high. They're self-medicating. They're fucking miserable. They want to die. I know people that purposely try to overdose to die, and then they go, you know, they get sent to the hospital and they're cared for physically until they're, you know, they get through the overdose and the withdrawal, but mental health wise, they don't get the help. It's like, okay, you're done your withdrawal, you're done your overdose is done, you can go home now. And same with addictions too, like mental health, people with mental illness will go into a treatment center, but then they're asked to leave because they're too depressed or they're suicidal. And so you get lost between this. He's not an addict, or he's an addict, but he's too depressed to be at a treatment center. He's depressed, but he's too much of an alcoholic or an addict to be in the psych ward. So, and that happened to me for like a few hours when I did go to the psych ward eventually after my suicide attempt. They were like juggling me around, like who takes care of this guy? And then the same thing happened again when the night I quit drinking, I was in the hospital for a couple of days and they didn't know if I should be in the psych ward or a treatment center. It's like, why are they so separate? Why is it two different things? It's the same fucking thing. Like, anyway.
And what happens is then you're stuck in a rock and a hard place, literally, because you don't know where you should be either. Is this a mental health issue? Is this an addiction issue? Like you said, a lot of times it's both. I know that was the problem with myself is, you know, I was going to see a counselor. I was going to get help, and nobody asked a question about my drug use. Nobody asked if I was drinking. Nobody asked if I was taking or self-medicating. And I was self-medicating for physical pain. And I rarely drank. With the reason I quit doing everything is because I overdosed myself. And, you know, when you wake up 19, 20 hours later and you're on your couch and you can't believe what you've just done, it's a wake up call. But, you know, I went to my doctor and I talked to my doctor about it, and, you know, nothing was done. And, you know, at that point in time, I could have gotten help because I was struggling coming off the prescription drugs. I was struggling with, you know, kind of going at it cold turkey. I had come off my antidepressants, you know, I was basically just self-medicating with marijuana at night, which I still do. But for me, it wasn't the fact that it was an addiction, right? I don't have an addictive personality. What it was my mental health, you know, being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. That's what it was. And so, you know, like you said, you're stuck between this rock and a hard place and you don't know where to go. You don't know how to almost fix yourself. My question for you, Todd, is how do we fix this, man? Like on the ground, with your boots on, and we're going to each an individual, you know, what should we be doing with these individuals? Because you're absolutely right. One thing that we've taken away from the Inner Man Project is, you know, we can make all the Facebook statuses and Facebook posts all we want, but it takes actually sitting down in front of these guys and helping them out.
Yeah. How to fix this. Wow, that's a loaded question. And hey, I come up with opinions, not solutions, man. For one thing, I mean, stigma is huge still, especially with addicts. So many people, so many things I read, it's still like it's their choice, you know, or it's like why are we giving addicts clean needles but not people with diabetes? And it's like, don't compare the two. I mean, they're both complete and utter illnesses. I mean, people I work with know they can die if they use again, and they still use again. That's insanity. And you know what I mean? Like, that's just as insane as a suicide attempt, right? Like, it's a disease. It's a sickness. So I think stigma, having empathy, don't cast judgment on people. You don't fucking know, man. Shut your fucking mouth. You have your own problems. Don't be entitled. Like, these people are sick. Just treat them with decency. I think governments have to do the same. I think it's starting to come around a bit. We are starting with addiction in Saskatchewan here. Like, we have a treatment center. You basically go from detox to a waiting period to treatment. And that waiting period, all types of people fall off the wagon and stuff. So now they're wanting to do something between detox and the treatment center, like a pre-treatment center. Quite often they leave treatment right back into the life lived. So now they're trying to do a post-treatment center place too. So, I mean, it's starting to change that way. I don't think there is one magic thing that'll fix everything, but I think for the average person, I mean, just have empathy and don't judge, really, is the biggest thing. Try to help to change the stigma. Treat this just like any other physical ailment. And I think the governments, the health regions, all these managers in the health regions all have to realize they have to treat this just like a physical ailment.
Yeah, those small wins are just those incredible, like the pre-treatment, the post-treatment, all that stuff's important. And like you said, so I work with youth, and I find that, you know, we can remove them from the situation momentarily, and that works great for them, but they have to go back at some point. And if they don't have the tools that are necessary to cope with, you know, what they're dealing with, or their home life, or their friends, or, you know, being able to say no, that kind of stuff, like, you're not having any success. You're basically just slapping a Band-Aid on something, right? And those
programs are
important, but like there seems to be no end game at this point, at least in our areas that I'm aware of. And that's where we really struggle. And I mean, we can hook these kids up and adults up. It doesn't matter. We can have them with workers. We can have, but at the end of the day, they don't go home with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's when the wheels are turning. That's when I need a drink, or I need to take a hit, or whatever. Right. And when you're sitting by yourself and you have no one there, that's when the relapses happen. That's when you make no progress. And it's sad to see. And we have all these professionals out there, like we had mentioned, that don't correlate addiction and mental health the same, but it doesn't take a professional to know that when you can use drugs, that you can create your own mental illness and your own psychosis, and you can go through those kind of things. So when people are getting turned away because they're high, that is the most asinine thing I've ever fucking heard in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like you need some kind of place that it treats addiction and mental illness in the same, under the same roof, you know, maybe down the hall, but in the same roof, the same ER system or something. I don't know. But yeah, we had a client in last year that she did wonderful. She was like, her 28th day was up. You can see the physical changes from the first day to the last day. She was amazing. She was glowing in the face. She found out she was pregnant with her husband while she was in treatment. She had three other kids at home, and she was glowing. Her last day, she was moping around. I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Well," and she started crying. She said, "My husband uses, my husband beats me. When I go home, I'm just basically right back to where she left." And I'm sure that 28 days was a wonderful vacation for her from her life, but it didn't change a damn thing. And my heart broke. But at the same time, you know, I did the best I could with my skills, with the people that are there at the time. Like I said, so, you know, sometimes it feels like I'm only one man. I can't change the whole system, but the time that they're there, I can try to make their lives easier, treat them with most empathy I can, and give them all, you know, try to help them the best I can, do the best job I can while they're in there. So, so it's weird. It's sometimes it's like, my heart breaks, but also I'm so grateful that I get to help these people at the same time. So it's a weird job, man.
We're with you. We're not naive thinking that we're going to save everyone with our project that we have going on. But I mean, just the fact that we've had individuals reaching out to us saying, like, if it wasn't for your group, I mean, I had a set plan that I was going to take my life this next following day, but you guys saved our life. And that's the winning moments. That's our why. That's what keeps us going for this kind of stuff. And it's one of those things that you wish you could do everything in your power to make sure that you have a safety plan in place once release happens. But once those doors open and then those individuals walk out the door, there's nowhere to go. And I think, that's where we need to figure out. That's where we need to pinpoint. What can we do with these individuals once they're done?
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, that's a tough question to answer, because that's the other thing with this treatment center. It's a wonderful treatment center, but it's, you know, it's not, it's cookie cutter sometimes. It's like not, it doesn't work for everyone, that method. It worked for me when I was in there, you know, but I had a ton of support when at home. I had, you know, my wife and kids at home. I got a doctor. I got all the support I needed here. So when I left, I was fine, but that 28-day treatment's not going to work for everybody. Like I said, that poor lady that, okay, now she's just right back into her situation, and it's, the cycle continues. But yeah.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, but I mean, like you said, you did what you could and everything in your own power to, you know, make this individual feel as comfortable and, you know, give some insight in on your stories and what you went through. And hopefully that's a safety guideline of how she's going to fall through on her life, right? And maybe this individual actually did turn it around, or helped her husband turn it around, or something happened that, you know, that you aren't going to see her again. And
that's true. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I just assume she's back in the, you know, in the shit of it. Who knows? I have no idea.
It really is. Yeah. Because, I mean, and what we do and what you do, there's a lot of doom and gloom, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, there
is. To pick apart the positives, but they do happen. I mean, they are rare, obviously. But when they do happen, it's like that's the stronghold. That's where you're like, wow, like this person pulled themselves out of the shit and they made it through after all the odds were against them. That's the heartwarming shit that we want. That's what we like to see and hear.
Yeah. And actually, it's, I don't want to harp on COVID, but one of the great things about Pine Lodge was former clients would come back and speak to the clients. You know, the success stories would come back and talk. And when I was a client in there, you would literally get 12 hugs a day. That was actually part of the treatment, is once after each session, everyone gets up and hugs each other and whatever. But because of COVID, there's no outside visitors. So there's no former clients coming in and talking about, you know, there's no positive out former patients coming in and talking about success stories. There's no one's allowed to touch each other. So there's no hugging. You can't even high five each other in there. Everyone's in masks and gloves. And so, you know, it's frustrating. And it's that whole cycle of the mental health thing again with COVID. It's like, even in treatment, you can't win because of goddamn COVID. So anyway, I was just throwing that in there too.
Go ahead, Dylan. I've been talking.
That's okay, buddy. You know, one of the things that we've noticed with our peer sessions is, you know, when you start talking to these men and these individuals that come to our sessions, a lot of men, they shy away from the conversation because they're like, oh, what the fuck does this guy know? Yada, yada, yada. And then all of a sudden you'll hear one guy speak up about his addiction and his adversity and how he overcome it and overcame it. And then all of a sudden the conversation flips because they understand that, oh, well, this person was an addict. This person dealt with schizophrenia. This person dealt with, you know, X, Y, and Z. And now all of a sudden this conversation becomes relatable. Now all of a sudden, yeah, this conversation goes from you basically letting them vent to saying, you know what, I went through the shit too. And, you know, when I hear that they're not preventing, or they are preventing other people from joining this treatment center, it's just a disservice to the people in there, because that's where the real connection comes in, is, you know, gentlemen like yourself going in, talking to these people, giving them the encouragement, you know what, it can be done. You know, you can make the right choices. You can get off the bottle. You can do things to better your life. It's going to take difficult work. It's going to take getting through the shit and the adversity. But at the end of the day, it is possible. You're taking that hope away from people, man. The second you stop letting that connection go, you start taking hope away from people. And I think it's so important, the work that you do, Todd, in terms of being at that treatment center and helping people, because that's what we've seen the success. It's, the private forum is great, and guys do get to vent and share experiences and meet up with other guys. But the peer support. I mean, when you have 30 guys at the end of the night giving each other hugs before they head out, it's a powerful feeling. And like Shane has said before on the show, you get this feeling of fulfillment and joy for the rest of the week, you know, and it's a powerful thing.
Yeah, it is. And I get it. Like, I mean, the health authority is not going to those rules aren't going to change, but it's better than just being shut down and not letting anyone in at all. You know, at least we have clients in there and we have our counselors in there helping, but it is a big positive part of the treatment is talking to the former clients and having that physical contact with each other and hugging and stuff. So it's unfortunate. It's just another reason to hate COVID, but you know, I'm not mad at anyone for making that decision. I totally get it. There's COVID going around in Indian Head, even our small town. So, I mean, I get it, but it's just unfortunate.
Doesn't make it any easier.
No, it doesn't. And
I have my own personal story when it comes to physical touch and how important it is I had a kid about 14 years old and he did something really good that I was pretty proud of him, and I gave him a high five, and just me sticking my hand out in the air to him and he did touching my hand, he kind of like looked at it and was like, holy shit, like someone actually cares. And that was like kind of that light in my head. I was like, this kid has never had a physical affirmation in his entire life. And that is so sad. And something as simple as a high five literally just made his week. And that's the heartbreaking shit that we're running into. We really reiterate this physical touch, no matter how, what form it is so important.
Yeah. When I was a client in there, one of my group members said his favorite part about treatment was the hugs. He'd never really had a hug until he came to treatment as like a 30-year-old man. So it's huge. Like, but whatever. I mean, COVID, what are you going to do? I know. You can read to your kids.
Yes, you can. Todd, before we get going here, I want you to give the listeners your social media, where they can find you, the website, the name of the book, and where they can find the book, man.
Okay, the name of the book is Sometimes Daddy Cries About a Kid Watching His Dad Go Through Depression, and he keeps comparing it to a physical ailment so that kids can make those comparisons and understand that. The Sometimes Daddy Cries on Facebook and goddamn Instagram. They've deleted like three of my accounts, but I just made a new one today. It's Daddy Cries Book is the Instagram. I had tons of pictures and stuff. Now I got like three pictures. Got to start all over again. I don't know. I did something Instagram didn't like, so they deleted my account, but what are you going to do? So I'm starting all over again. And you can buy the book on Amazon.
Awesome. Are we? Well, No. This is. I just wanted to say that this is a fantastic book. I had a read this afternoon. I kind of read it out loud to the whole family here, and it is a fascinating book because you hit on, you know, you make it readable so kids can understand. But man, like I was almost tearing up by the end of it because it hits home for me. It does. It hits home for me personally because I know exactly. You know, I know exactly what that story feels like, you know, because you know, there's been times in my life where I've felt that with my kids and my wife. And, you know, I fortunately haven't had to go to those extremes of being in the hospital. But it's when I read that, man, I swelled up and I was reading it out loud to the whole family here. And it was powerful, man. It was powerful.
Oh, thanks. I rushed through all my stuff there. I thought we were ending. I didn't realize we were going to keep talking.
Oh, we do gotta get going. Yeah, we do gotta get going.
Okay, okay. Dad, I'm so confused. We're leaving.
No, man, Todd, I really appreciate it. Shane, any final thoughts, comments?
Yeah, just to touch on what you said, Dylan. It doesn't matter if you went through a mental illness or any of that kind of stuff. It's just a matter of fact. When you're a dad, you have a lot of pressures. You have a lot of expectations pressed upon you. So this is a relatable book to literally everyone. So check it out, because I think it's important for everyone to read, because it is okay to show those emotions. It's okay to feel vulnerable, and it's okay to reach out. And I think it's important to be transparent with your family, what you're going through. So, I mean, you set an example for your little ones right out the gate. And that's something that we think as at the Inner Man Project, that transparency and the communication is so important. So follow through on that. And, you know, that I think that's just going to help family dynamics and yourself just, you know, heal better.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm super proud of the book, and I'm super proud of the illustrator. And yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, it's almost taken a shape of its own, the, because of all the feedback I'm getting. It's like, it's, I don't know, I'm just so proud of it. There's so many subject matters all wrapped up into one kid book, from parent guilt to early conversations with children to, yeah, I don't know. Just, I hate pumping my own tires, but
but you should, really, man. Proud of the book. You should be proud. You should be proud. And it's very admirable, you know, what you have done. You made it relatable too. And that's the biggest thing, is I could read this to my son and my boys, and they'd understand it, and I get something from it as well. So, you know what, Todd, we appreciate you being on the show, man. Hold tight.
My pleasure.
I'll keep you on the line here. Thanks everybody for tuning in.